Blog Talk Radio.
Children of all ages, this is the 411 Ground and Pound Radio Show, your weekly look into the wide, wacky, wonderful world of mixed martial arts. I'm your host, Robert Winfrey, and before we get going, another big thank you to everyone out there for tuning in. I'm aware of the choices you have when it comes to MMA podcasts. Dozens, hundreds, possibly even thousands. And for whatever reason, you choose ours, and I'm very, very grateful for that. I say this frequently here. Time is the only truly finite resource we have. Everything else you can get more of, by and large. Time is, to the best of our ability to comprehend, linear. And you're choosing to use some of your time with us here on this show, and it means a lot to me. I thank you all very much for listening. All right, tonight on the show, we will be focusing primarily on reviewing last night's pay-per-view event, UFC 198. Brazilian showcase that included a guy from Cleveland becoming heavyweight champion. The Brazilians had a pretty good night, but yeah, Stipe Miocic shut that entire stadium up. You could have heard a pin drop in that place after he knocked out Verdum. So we're going to be talking about that. The co-main event, Geraldo Jacare Souza, continues to be awesome. That's basically it. A few of the, any major news that, broke last week. We'll talk a little bit about Anderson Silva not being on this card because, a medical emergency is nothing to sneeze at, but that's what's going on there. So, just the basic outline we have for the show. If any of that strikes your fancy, if you're out there and you have a question, you have a comment, you want something discussed, anything other than a long string of profanity, I am more than happy to put you on the air here. We take live callers at 323-657-0901. Once again, 323-657-0901. If you would like to call in using Skype, you have to be on the Blog Talk Radio player page. There is a Skype icon. It's on the top of the player, off-center to the right. Click on that, then you're going to have to click through three or four boxes of dialogue. After you get done with that, you'll come up in my switchboard, and I will get you on the air. So feel free to call in. Always happy to take calls. Let's get your opinion known out there. All right. Here with me, as always, my regular partner in crime, 411 Mania's jack of all trades, because he's in all the zones, and he works very hard. Jeff Harris is with us again. How you doing this evening, Jeff?
It's the J to the E to the double F Ree, who's here to say, all the little chicks with the crimson lips say Cleveland rocks. Congratulations, Stipe Miocic.
I'm still waiting on documented proof of that statement being accurate, but I'll take your word for it in the interim. All right, let's jump on to this. The main event, I already mentioned it a little bit. Stipe Miocic knocks out Fabricio Verdum in the first round. One punch. Really nice shot. I'm a bit annoyed with myself for not predicting this one accurately. I know last week Jeff and I both talked about Miocic having ways to win. This was a very competitive fight on paper. It annoys me because I hate getting things wrong when I have perfect information. Now, you never have completely perfect information because someone might have an injury they haven't disclosed. Someone might have been developing a new skill set that can't necessarily be accounted for, but that wasn't the case here. This was simply knowledge that everyone had, and for some reason, I looked at it and I got it wrong. And it bothers me when that happens. Whenever I make picks, I try to do the best that I can, and it bothers me when I miss something that should be somewhat obvious in a lot of ways. And this, I'm not trying to bag on Verdum and say he, you know, this was a given for Stipe, but you know, Stipe's style is very reactionary in a lot of ways. He can be very proactive, but one of the things, and I rewatched the Cain Velasquez fight with Verdum not too long ago. Verdum did a great job of countering Cain when Cain was coming forward, beating him up in the clinch, and then hitting him when they would exit. Now, he got hit along the way, and it's a competitive fight. But he struggles when he has to go forward. He's much more comfortable kind of fighting, you know, one or two shots from the outside and then getting counters when his opponent moves forward. And Miocic did not go forward in reckless, aggressive fashion. He was content to, you know, work on the outside a little bit as well, work some leg kicks, you know, land punches whenever he could find an angle to do so safely. And eventually Verdum got, I don't know if he got frustrated, I don't know if he got reckless, I don't know exactly what went on in his head. He charged forward with his chin up in the air, throwing punches, a couple of which landed, and Miocic just backed up, circled away, landed a beautiful right hook to the jaw. Verdum collapsed unconscious, and Stipe Miocic is the first man in several decades to bring a world title to the city of Cleveland, Ohio. Before LeBron James and the Cavaliers, before the Browns, before the Indians, Stipe Miocic did it, everybody. I'm a little bit annoyed that I didn't get that one right, because I feel like all the information was there, and I should have, but apart from that, the man just became champion. You know, his only two losses, I think, in his career were an early setback to Stefan Struve and a close decision to Junior Dos Santos. This is a stud. Stipe Miocic is a stud, and you know, he's in a really good spot to be champion for a while. No one's been able to defend the heavyweight title more than twice, in the UFC at least. No one's hit three successful title defenses. Two has been the limit so far. He's in a good position to break that as long as he's able to... The biggest threat is probably Cain, and even then, I like, at this point, Miocic's chances against Cain Velasquez. I don't see anyone else being too much of a problem for him on the immediate horizon, but it's heavyweight, and it's an unforgiving division. You make one mistake, and you're unconscious. Fabricio Verdum was on his way to becoming the best heavyweight ever, at least being in that discussion. One mistake, he's unconscious, and we're back to square one. All right, Jeff, what did you think about this one? That was
I think you're being a little melodramatic, Robert. Because, again, there are so many variables in the fight game. And no matter how many times or how many ways we can examine a fight and examine a matchup, there are just so many issues that we can't always examine that come up during weigh-ins. We don't always have a microscope on how these guys are training, how hard they're training, how they're feeling mentally. Fabricio Verdum was fighting at home. He was fighting in this isn't your normal UFC crowd, Robert. We're talking about a stadium full of 45,000 people. So think about that. Fighting in Brazil, he's finally become champion, and to me, Verdum looked a little soft in this fight, and he's looked soft in fights before, and those are some of the fights where he's lost and not had great performances. But, you know, we can't always anticipate that when we break these fights down right before the fight's happening until, you know, we see a guy on fight week. And, I mean, to me, I sort of remembered, do you remember when Verdum got knocked out by Junior Dos Santos? That was in 2008. So that was about 7.5
like 200 and he weighed some. He went over 250 for that fight. He looked really soft.
Right. And he clearly underestimated, you know, a guy, you know, a young prospect making his debut in Junior Dos Santos. I mean, no one expected us for that to happen. A lot of people were seeing Verdum as the next title contender. that didn't happen. And Verdum, he was the guy who went on to become the champion anyway. And Verdum had to work his way back to the UFC after that loss. So, but no one predicted that was going to happen. No one knew. All we really knew was that Junior Dos Santos was this guy, you know, he was this protege of Nogueira, and, you know, he was coming in to the UFC making his UFC debut. Why would anyone have picked Junior Dos Santos for that fight? There was no good reason, really. But he still knocked out, you know, a top heavyweight title contender. And here, you know, how do we anticipate how Verdum is going to come out and fight like that? Come out moving forward, but also being very sloppy and very reckless. And I think we knew that Miocic is a good boxer. He uses defensive boxing very well here. But how are we supposed to predict exactly how a guy is going to come out and approach a fight like this? There are just some things we can't anticipate, and I don't really think you need to be ashamed about that and be that broken up about it. I got a lot of picks wrong, too. Sometimes, you know, there are some cards, Robert, like the last fight night card, where everything sort of went the way we expected and the way we predicted. This card, not so much. But, you know, again, there are extenuating circumstances, and I don't really think you should be too broken up about that.
I'm only annoyed when I feel it's stuff that I should have known already. I mean,
what did you have known already that you didn't know here? Or that you did? What did you know? What did you know already that you just ignored?
I honestly underappreciated Miocic's punching power. To be perfectly honest about that,
he's made a habit of not letting his hands go and just being very defensive with his technique. You know, I mean, do you expect him to really finish Verdum in the first round like this? You know,
no.
Honestly, even had I picked Miocic,
I would not have picked a first-round finish. I would have imagined him wearing Verdum out over the course of four or five rounds.
Exactly. He's not – no, it's not a science to break down a fight and figure out, okay, Verdum's going to come out, he's going to move forward, he's going to leave his head open, and Miocic is going to use his defensive boxing, moving backward and land a flush straight punch on Verdum and knock him out in one punch. I mean, you can't – there are just too many complexities to this game, and I feel like – I don't know why you're so disappointed. I feel like there are just so many things in this game we can't see.
I know, and when I'm wrong because of things that I feel like I couldn't have possibly known, again, that's the way it goes. When I'm wrong because
like
of things that I feel I should have known, that's when I get –
like,
What
you should have known for Anthony Pettis, Edson Barboza is that Barboza is really, he's really good when you give him time to find his rhythm and find his pace.
Yeah, honestly, that one annoys me too because I went with Pettis for, I don't know why I talked myself into that one.
But here's how I feel. I think Verdum was reckless. He was sloppy. And that's just something I think maybe he was mentally, maybe feeling mentally off from the presence of being on such a big stage, even though he's fought on, you know, comparatively big stages before. But I think we also had good reason to pick Verdum as well, just based on what he's done and the way he's made so many improvements, because sometimes a fighter has flaws in his game and we don't even really see those flaws closing up, and then they work on those flaws and they're able to make adjustments in the next fight. And sometimes it takes several fights to truly see those improvements really gradually get built up. And I think it was a good performance by Miocic. He was patient. His boxing was sharp. His boxing definitely didn't fail him here. But let's also not forget, you know, Miocic has a lot of flaws in his game too, and he is far from unbeatable. And even though the heavyweight division has a depth problem, it's competitive because these guys are so big and because they have so much punching power. So that's kind of what does make the division interesting. Because no champion, think about this, no UFC heavyweight champion has ever defended their title more than twice.
It's true.
Not even Cain Velasquez.
No, Velasquez's first title reign didn't even get one.
Exactly. And this is, I mean, Verdum didn't even, unless you count the interim title, Verdum didn't even get one.
We don't count the interim title.
All right, you're not counting it. So Verdum didn't even get one either.
Nope.
So, and Junior Dos Santos, I mean,
only had one.
I mean, Junior Dos Santos slayed the Cain Velasquez dragon. He only got one. And then he lost the title back to Cain. So, this is when these guys are big guys. They have a ton of punching power. And one shot can just change the whole complexion of the entire fight. It's that simple.
Yeah, it's odd heavyweight is, it's not the weakest division in the UFC, but it's certainly one of them. And despite the relative lack of talent, especially compared with something like lightweight or welterweight, historically, the top of heavyweight is more competitive in the sense that you don't have dominant heavyweight forces.
Right.
Certainly not to the extent that we've had, you know, a BJ Penn or a George St. Pierre at, you know, lightweight or welterweight respectively, who's just had periods where they were the man. We've never had that in the UFC's heavyweight division.
I think what Miocic deserves credit here for was showing grace under pressure, showing patience and not being overwhelmed by being put in a scenario where he's fighting a Brazilian at a Brazilian soccer stadium in Curitiba and being able to deal with that. And he's always had good boxing. He probably has some of the best cardio for any heavyweight in the UFC right now. So we knew he could go into the championship rounds if he needed to. And I don't know if he has better boxing than Junior Dos Santos has shown, you know, through just going career by career, but he has some very good boxing for a heavyweight. He's a very well-rounded fighter. And he countered Verdum very well. I don't know why Verdum was just so aggressive and sloppy like that, but that's what happened. And I don't really think that's something you can necessarily predict. I didn't think Verdum was going to go in so quickly against a guy like Miocic.
Yeah, there were a few other fighters on this card who people have speculated they got a little bit amped up by being, you know, in Brazil in front of their, you know, hometown fans, and they got a little bit anxious to put on a good show instead of fighting solid, you know, technical performances.
But how about how silent that stadium was after Verdum lost? We're talking, this is a stadium, guys. This is not like your regular arena. It had over 45,000 people, and after Verdum got stopped, it was utter silence. You could have heard a mouse pissing on cotton in the rafters. That's how it was.
It reminded me of the way the crowd reacted after Rashad Evans knocked out Chuck Liddell. I mean, it was that kind of just...
It was stunned silence. It was that's an amazing moment.
It is. It really is. And the guy jumps over... completely jumped over the octagon after the win. Amped up, clear. You know, big ups to Miocic for finally getting that, for getting his shot, for capitalizing on it the way he did. And I'm going to be honest, I think he's got a pretty good first defense coming up, because there are only two candidates, really, for your next title defense if you're Stipe Miocic. You're either going to fight Alistair Overeem, who's on a 3-fight winning streak, I think.
4-fight, I think.
It's 3 or 4. His last 2 have been knockouts. He knocked out Junior Dos Santos. He knocked out Andre Arlovsky. He's a guy who the UFC has been kind of keen to get into the title picture since his arrival. And I'm going to be honest, if I'm Stipe Miocic, Alistair Overeem is kind of the fight I want. He's a powerful puncher, but he's a lot more singular with his strikes because his chin's a tad compromised. His conditioning is maybe not where not to the level of Miocic at the very least. I think that's a very winnable fight for Stipe.
Overeem does not throw straight punches. I think if I'm Stipe Miocic and I want a more favorable matchup, it's Alistair Overeem. And that's the fight they should make. You can finally put Overeem in the title fight that fans have wanted, you know, for the last 5 years. And he'll probably lose and, or win, and we'll finally have – you can talk about how he's won all these belts and all these organizations, and we'll go from there. But I talked about him in my column last week. Overeem is the guy to book for the heavyweight title right now. Cain Velasquez is just too unreliable at this point, and if he got booked in that fight, chances are you'd have to rebook it anyway.
There's a pretty good chance of that coming up. And again, I mentioned this last night to a couple of people. At this point in Cain's career with, you know, some of the miles on his body, I'm not sure I'd pick him to beat Stipe because while Cain has, the two are similar, different in many ways, but they are similar fighters. And Miocic is just, you know, he doesn't have that same level of damage that Velasquez has taken. So he's in a pretty good spot for a couple of fights at the very least.
If he can keep fighting, if he can keep fighting like this, especially.
As for Verdum, I know he said he wanted an immediate rematch, but
No way, Jose.
No. Not only are we sick of rematches in general, you got knocked. If you get finished in the first round, unless it is an egregiously bad stoppage by the referee, which has happened in the past, mind you, but barring that, I don't like immediate rematches if you're finished in the first round. I think they're utterly unwarranted.
All right. First of all, let's give it up for Overeem and what he Verdum. Let's give it up for Verdum and what he – look, 8 years ago, his career was in the dumps, okay? He was on the road to getting a UFC title shot. He got knocked out in 90 seconds by Junior Dos Santos, and he got fired by the UFC. He worked his way back to the UFC. This included ending, you know, sort of the – he destroyed the myth of Fedor. He got his way back into the UFC, and he hasn't lost. He hasn't lost since he returned to the UFC, and he beat Cain Velasquez. He won the heavyweight title. He beat everyone put in front of him. I mean, that's – I mean, the way he turned his career around from where it was – over 7 years ago, it's spectacular. Few athletes are able to turn their career around like that, especially after what Verdum went through. But you're not getting a rematch, Verdum. You got knocked out. You got finished. Okay, you can't. That was your first title defense. We can't just give immediate rematches willy nilly just because. Okay, yeah, it was an impressive career comeback, but you lost your title on your first defense, man, and you got finished. Okay, that's not how immediate rematches should work.
Yeah, I agree completely. I mean, to be perfectly honest, even after Jose Aldo got knocked out, I have a lot of respect for Aldo, what he did over his, you know, career. I have a lot of respect for his abilities as a fighter, his tenure. He got knocked out in the first round, man. I mean, again, I respect your history, but a definitive first round finish means you have to fight. You have to win at least one more. Now he's getting an interim title shot, but well, you know, that division's a tad wonky at the moment because Conor McGregor's a little bit weird. I'm not sure where exactly who Verdum fights next exactly. I mean, you could do on.
I love that fight. Rematch
with
Dos Santos.
JDS.
Look, Dos Santos is not. He got a good win over Rothwell, but he's not quite yet on the cusp of the title shot. He's gonna need a fight. Verdum coming off this loss is a great fight. And if I'm Verdum, if I want a do-over over any moment in my career, would you not want that fight with Dos Santos again?
Either that or a rematch with Alistair Overeem where you can avoid flopping like a beached trout.
Let me, no. They fought twice. We don't, that their last fight was awful. No.
It really was.
No, Winfrey. Bad Winfrey. Bad.
I'm just saying, it's one of those two. He and JDS in a rematch would be a pretty good one. I'm all for that. All right, in the co-main event, we had this one did not quite go as expected.
It went exactly as we expected, okay? Now, sometimes they go the opposite way. This fight, not so much. This is exactly what we knew was going to happen, and this is what should have happened.
No, not exactly. I did not expect
annihilated.
I did not expect Belfort to get beat that badly. I expected Sosa to win. Picked him to win. I thought he'd get a submission, and once he got to mount, I thought he'd spin for an arm, but instead he just punched Vitor until the ref stopped it, which was a good decision on his part. This was a shockingly one-sided affair. Ronaldo Jacare Sosa defeated Vitor Belfort in the first round.
It was especially not shocking when Belfort came out looking like a lightweight at the weigh-ins, looking like Vitor's little brother, Vito.
Matt, yeah. Vitor's, the physical changes that man has gone since the banning of TRT are pretty drastic. This one in particular, I did not expect Sosa to have that much of a size advantage, but he did. He used it effectively. Man, his entries for takedowns were pretty poor in some of these, in a couple of these instances. But Jacare does a great job of, once he gets a hold of you, however he happened to get there, somehow being able to transition that into a grappling exchange that works in his favor. In this fight, even, he darn near pulled. Was it this fight or was it a? It was the Damian Maia fight with Matt Brown. Excuse me, different fight. Same general principle. Maia actually pulled not just guard. He basically pulled Matt Brown into full mount, and then still was able to reverse the position and get his back. But Sosa has kind of that same thing where, even if his double leg isn't a traditional wrestler's double leg, if he gets his hands around even a low ankle pick, if you can't get away from him quickly, he's going to transition that. He's going to keep you grappling, and you're going to be screwed. His jiu-jitsu is just that sensational.
I mean, look, Belfort's takedown defense has always been bad, and it's been bad for over a decade. A grappler like Jacare is a nightmare for Belfort.
Yeah, he got a good first takedown, beat up Belfort from half guard, cut him open on the bridge of the nose. Belfort escaped. He got taken down. He basically pulled guard on that second takedown, a terrible decision. But once Belfort gets hurt, he seems to mentally check out of a fight. He got taken, and Jacare's guard passing is just... I'm not entirely sure I have adequate words. He might have the best guard passing game in the sport. And that includes guys like Damian Maia, Cain Velasquez, who has pretty good passing himself, Rafael Dos Anjos, all of them. Jacare might have the best guard passing. He cut through Vitor's guard like... I have a hard time imagining me putting up a better fight to retain guard than Vitor Belfort did. And I know nothing of grappling. In general practicality, he cut through it like it wasn't even there, got high full mount, and just unloaded until the fight was over. give Jacare his title shot, man. That guy, his only loss in the UFC was a controversial split decision loss to Yoel Romero that a lot of people think he won. I seem to recall scoring it for Souza. Give that man his title shot. He's more than earned it.
Is that even really a loss after the failed drug test?
They did not overturn the results because it was unintentional. It's still a loss.
Yeah. To me, it doesn't count.
A lot of people feel the same way you do about that. And again, even though it stands as a loss, that was a controversial split decision. Even if there had been no, you know, drug test issues with Romero, it's still a highly competitive fight.
He's going to beat the winner of Rockhold versus Weidman. Just you watch, Winfrey.
Yeah, give the man his title shot. You're going to pick him to win, huh?
I will. If he gets booked in a title fight, I will.
I would pick him to beat Weidman. I'm not sure about Rockhold. I'm not sure.
They fought before, and Rockhold did a good job, but I still felt that Jacare won that fight.
I scored that first fight for Rockhold, but that was a very competitive fight. They've both improved by leaps and bounds since then.
And again, it's in this matchup of inches. I just like the way Jacare matches up with Rockhold better than I do Rockhold, personally.
Yeah, fair enough. It's a very competitive fight.
It's just like the way I think Rockhold. I really like the way Rockhold beats the way he matches up with Weidman. I feel like he beats Weidman every time. It's just that's how I see the matchups.
All right.
That is why, unlike you, Robert, I was not shocked at all that Belfort was eaten alive by the alligator.
I was a little shocked at just how one-sided it was.
I was not shocked at all. I knew that was going to happen. I knew Souza was going to – I knew Belfort, you know, he was gonna take a dip in the pond, and he was going to find that this pond is occupied by a man-eating alligator, and that alligator was not going to have any pity on the idiot that wandered into his pond without his permission.
As for Belfort, I don't know what he does from here. He can fight Dan Henderson again, I guess. I don't know. I joke, but you know, Belfort still has power, but he crumbles if things don't go his way. And you know, the guy abused his body for a long time with steroids, with TRT, and now physically he's starting to pay the price for that. So I don't see him matching up with any of the, you know, true studs of the division, but if he wants to keep fighting, they can keep finding places for him, I think.
Fight Uriah Hall. How about that?
If I have some kind of written guarantee that Vitor Belfort will just blitz Uriah Hall and end him quickly.
Or he could fight Musasi.
I wouldn't hate that fight either. All right. Up next was supposed to be a fight between Uriah Hall and Anderson Silva. Did not happen. A few days before the event, Anderson Silva developed acute cholecystitis, excuse me. It's a problem with the gallbladder. He had to have it removed. Reports are that he had his gallbladder removed. Things that go wrong with your gallbladder can go wrong in a hurry. That's kind of what happened here. He was in town. He was, you know, planning on making weight and then just got violently ill. You know, he went to a doctor who told, you know, you've potentially got this problem. He went in, he had surgery, wish him a speedy recovery. Uriah Hall decided he wasn't going to take a replacement fight. It would have been on, you know, literally day's notice. And, you know, if Uriah Hall loses to a replacement fighter, which he very well might, Uriah Hall is, I've talked about it, so is Jeff, he's a very spotty competitor, then he's kind of done. If he can try and get a, you know, rescheduled fight with Anderson or just switch opponents entirely a little bit further down the line, he should do. I'm okay with him doing that. I was I'm never happy when a fight falls through. I did not care about this one because I maintain it would have been a 15-minute staring contest. With both guys afraid to lead the fight, so to speak. So moved up to the third spot was the UFC debut of Christiane Cyborg Justino. She ran over Leslie Smith in the first round. This fight lasted 81 seconds. Cyborg just obliterated her. I mean, which we all, this went exactly as expected. Leslie Smith's a striker who was going to accommodate a much more powerful striker. Anytime they got close, Cyborg's landing those big power hooks, Smith fell over, Cyborg hit her a few more times, and the ref stopped it. Again, exactly as expected. I mean, Jeff, again, as expected, right?
I have nothing to add.
It was a good win for Cyborg. It was good to see her get on the UFC stage. This has been a long time coming for reasons that were never made particularly clear or made a whole lot of sense in a lot of ways.
Well, for starters, when the UFC signed her in 2013, she and her manager, Tito Ortiz, then promptly asked for her release. Go figure.
Tito Ortiz has suffered a tremendous amount of brain trauma. That's all I have to explain that. I really have to say this. I generally approved of the analyst desk they had for this group. It was Kenny Florian. It was Jay Glazer setting up the questions for Kenny Florian, Daniel Cormier, and Stephen Thompson. They generally did a good job. I was not a fan of them kind of pushing the idea of Cyborg cutting to 135. We've had this conversation before, people.
She weighed in at 139 for the fight. And even though she didn't really look that great in some of her Instagram pics, I mean, I think they're just thinking, well, she weighed in 139. She's only four away. The problem is there's no division above 135 in the UFC for the women. And all the big fights for her would be at 135. Otherwise, it's just catchweight super fights, basically. And going back to Invicta and being, you know, champion of nothing.
I just, for whatever reason, I don't know if she can make 135. She's mentioned in the past that she can't. And if she physically can't make the weight safely, then we are where we are with that. And it bothered me the fact that they all said, yeah, Cyborg, come on, cut to 135. It bothered me in the sense that it's not like she's never attempted that cut before.
It only bothers because she's a documented cheater and steroid abuser. And she has radically altered her body through using steroids. And, you know, I met her and talked to her in 2009. She does not even sound like the same person anymore. And I'm not trying to be mean.
That's true. You can listen to her her interviews between now and then. She's done a number on her body. If the result of that is she can't make 135 safely, I don't think there should be any greater, you know, punishment you can't make 135.
I think you can do these type of matchups for her. Okay, she can be her whatever champion in Invicta, and if there's a fight to maybe make for her at catchweight in the UFC, then, you know, go ahead and make it.
I honestly am perfectly fine with that situation being the way things are going forward. I'm okay with just, you know, the occasional super fight in the UFC and letting her remain featherweight champion at Invicta.
I'm still not a fan, but that's kind of how. I'm not going to deny her the opportunity to make a living and fight in the UFC, you know, but whatever. That's what we're dealing with right now.
You have a very level-headed approach to that, Jeff. Certainly more so than a lot of other people. As for Leslie Smith, she protested the stoppage a little bit, which kind of made me laugh because she got clobbered. She got clobbered pretty hard. But you know, I don't think she's in danger of losing her job. She's still a fun fighter. She will be fine. She's never going to be. She was never a top level bantamweight anyway. Nothing.
It was the sacrificial lamb for Cyborg. It's that simple. But yeah. You know, you need the sacrificial lamb. You need those guys to build the resumes and, you know, do the job that some fighters will not be willing to do.
And I will say this, Leslie Smith was a more competitive fighter for Cyborg than two of her previous three opponents in Invicta. Because, man, Cyborg is just a force of nature in a lot of ways. But, you know, good for her. She got a good, you know, good win. The crowd ate it up. A lot of people around, you know, a lot of fans around the world finally got introduced to her on the big stage. I'm fine with all that. At light heavyweight, Mauricio Shogun Hua defeated Corey Anderson via split decision. 29-28 for Anderson, 29-28 for Shogun. I scored this fight for Anderson. The confusion, I believe, as far as the scoring for this fight goes, arises from the second round. Shogun pretty clearly had the first round. He had he controlled it. He landed leg kicks. He had a big knockdown towards the end of the round. He had a good flurry to follow it up with. I mean, the reality is if there's, you know, 30 more seconds in that round, he probably finishes Corey Anderson, but his own choices as far as the timing of his strikes go and, you know, so on and so forth. Anderson had a very good second round. He did a much better job kind of controlling the fight. This was not an action-filled fight, but he did a better job of, you know, landing his punches, of not letting Shogun dictate the pace. Then in the last 3 seconds or so, he throws a bit of a lazy leg kick. It gets caught. Shogun punches him and he falls over. This was not a violent knockdown. This was not a, you know, he didn't get knocked out by the punch. He got hit. He got hit clean. But it was, watching it live, I felt it was more he was off balance than he got really tagged. But he got hit and he fell over. Now, how I see that in this case, again, being more of a slip than a knockdown, maybe colors the fact that I think Anderson, because Anderson won the rest of that round. The whole problem stems from those last few exchanges when he got hit and slipped more than a knockdown. But if you saw it as a knockdown, then I can see giving that round to Shogun. If you saw it the way I saw it, then, and it's a very minor footnote to Anderson winning the second round. And then Anderson won the third round, clearly, with wrestling and a little bit of, and mostly with wrestling, some pressure. Not a great fight. I couldn't clucky this fight because I can understand why, again, if you think, and I might have to rewatch the fight and redetermine if that was a legitimate knockdown or if my first impression was correct. If that was a legitimate knockdown and just I didn't see it properly, then I have no problem with Hua winning because knockdowns score pretty heavily for me, especially when they're, you know, impactful. Not what I saw, that's why I scored it the way I did, but the fight was generally speak, the second round especially, was just a bit too close for me to clucky a 29-28 either way. Shogun did not look especially good in this fight. He's been trying to adapt his skill set more to what he has to offer as a fighter at this point. That's a lot less of the reckless aggression he used to have. A little bit more kicking game. I mean, the man's knees are shot, so his clinch game is nowhere near what it used to be. He used to just eat you alive in the clinch with knees to the body and head. Not a part of his game anymore. His kicks are still good. He's the problem that he's facing right now is trying to figure out how to still be effective with his offense while not being as wild as he has in the past. And it's a tough transition to make. Corey Anderson, again, I scored it for him, but he was very clearly a tentative fighter in there. And for a young guy who's got only a little over 10 fights in his career, fighting, you know, the second best light heavyweight fighter of all time, that's going to get in your head. And it did for him. And his performance suffered accordingly. But it's not a big setback. Again, he arguably won the fight. He is still one of like two prospects the division has. Shogun got a feel-good win in his hometown, but is still not exactly, you know, relevant at the top of the division. This was just kind of there. This is not a very good fight. Jeff, I know you were pretty disappointed with Shogun in this one.
I was disappointed with everybody here, but I mean, I kind of expected this out of Anderson to a degree. And look, I did score the fight for Anderson, but I think that last round, he tried to wall and stall through that round a little bit, and I think that's ultimately what cost him the fight. And I figured that look, you're in Brazil. You're in Shogun's hometown. I think he's lived in and trained in Curitiba. So to do that, you know the odds are probably – yeah, Shogun is from Curitiba, okay? So
yeah.
I think you have to be aware of that. And look, MMA judging is already spotty as it is, but it was a close fight. I think he shouldn't have expected to have guaranteed to have that first round in the bag. You're fighting Shogun. I think you need to do a little more than what he was doing later in the fight. And I think he this is what I call playing the points game. Anderson played the points game, and by trying to play it, he ultimately lost. So I'm not really too upset because it was a close fight. It was not an action-packed fight, and the more significant moments in the fight arguably went to Shogun. And I think Anderson has only himself to blame for that. I'll give Shogun this. He looked in pretty good shape for this fight. This was good for him getting a win in his hometown. This guy was a prospect, so this doesn't really make him a relevant title contender. But I mean, good for him. He got the win at home. So I don't really want to take too much away from Shogun here, but didn't really like the fight.
Yeah, I agree with that. All right, kicking off the main card, we had Brian Barberina defeating Warley Alves via unanimous decision, 329-28.
Another underdog. Good.
Big
good
underdog.
Nice to be underdogs on this card, really.
There were quite a few underdogs that paid off. Barberina was a substantial underdog, if memory serves. Something on the nature of 5-1.
Right. I mean, Alves was undefeated, so.
Yeah, I'm a little bit annoyed for picking wrong this time as well, because Alves had looked very, very good so far in his UFC. He'd won three or four fights in the UFC. Undefeated as a professional. But Brian Barberina is the type of fighter that takes young guys who have never been tested through adversity and puts them through the ringer. He's not going to go away. This is not a guy you can go in there and just blitz with, you know, power and raw aggression and get out of there in 2 minutes. He's not gonna panic if you put him in a guillotine choke that's not tight enough. He's going to be patient. He's going to let you burn your arms out. He's going to fight his way out of it intelligently. Then you're underneath him. Your arms are a little bit gassed, and he's going to start elbowing you in the face. That's pretty much what happened here. Alves had a pretty good first round. Again, jumped for a guillotine. He likes to do that. Wasn't a bad attempt. Wasn't a bad jump for it. This was, you know, again, very early in the first round. Had a pretty good grip for a second or two there, but Barberina, well-trained, not going to panic. fought his way out of it, and just over the course of the second and third round, I think actually gave him the first round, and then Alves the second. I'd have to double check my coverage. But Barbarina just outworked him. Just kept pressuring. Anytime they got in the clinch, kept hitting him with elbows, kept walking him down. Just the type of thing that he does to fighters who have never had to overcome adversity, who have never hit somebody in the face as hard as they can, had the other guy smile and keep on coming. If you're not prepared for that, he's going to beat you because you're going to gas. You're going to just decide you want out, and he's going to keep coming. Good win for Barbarina. I've got to stop. There were a couple of fights on this card that made me have to reexamine some of my habits that come with picking fights. Barbarina against, the young, talented, untested prospect. You got to start picking him in those fights, guys, by and large. He's not going to be overwhelmed by you. He's going to overwhelm you when you can't put him away. Alves, first career loss. He's still, young, still exciting, still got, there's still improvements to be made, but he'll be back. Barbarina will keep climbing the ranks at welterweight. He's not a, top 15 guy or anything, but he's doing well in that division. He's going to keep moving up in the world. Jeff, what'd you think of old Bam Bam there pulling off killing another prospect?
It was a good performance, a good workmanlike performance. Barbarina is turning into a very solid hand for this division, and we can't keep overlooking him. I'm not sure if he can become a force in the division, but he's turning in to quite a talented, consistent fighter. And if he can continue having, performances like this, where, he can play the spoiler, that's going to work very well for his career in the long run. But he still has that loss to Chad Laprise on his record. So, he's not unbeatable, but, this is a good role for him. And now I'm more interested to see who he's matched up with next.
All right, that was the main card. The Barbarina and Alves fight got bumped to the main card after Anderson Silva and Uriah Hall had to be called off. On the prelims, Damian Maia defeated Matt Brown via submission in the third round, rear naked choke. Two things about this. One, Matt Brown's survival and defense on the ground have improved tremendously. Better part, Damian Maia had his back this fight went 14 and a half minutes. Damian Maia had his back for 13 minutes and 40 seconds type thing. He had his back almost that entire fight. And it wasn't until the very end that Maia was able to get his arm under his neck. Now, he wasn't defending and countering, but he was surviving with, if not the best, then the second best grappler in the UFC right now. And the improvements he made in that area need to be acknowledged. Secondly, Damian Maya's jiu-jitsu is just so good. There's nothing to critique about it. It's perfect. It's impeccable from step to step to step. Even the way he was setting up those arm bars from the back in the closing seconds of each round, going for an armbar from back mount is one thing. It's an underutilized technique as far as MMA goes in general. But he was doing it from the body triangle, which is a much more difficult thing to do. One of the advantages of hooks in back mount as opposed to the body triangle is the versatility of your attack. With the body triangle, you generally can't set up an arm attack because your legs don't have the speed and the mobility to necessarily go up as fast and trap the arm like you do when you just have double hooks in. And Damian Maia doesn't care. He's good enough that it doesn't matter if he's not in the optimum position. He's still able to nearly submit Matt Brown with an arm bar from transitioning from a body triangle from the back. It's insane. I mean, this guy's jiu-jitsu is just... And people who know so much more about jiu-jitsu than I do are the ones saying this. This isn't just me. It's staggering how good his jiu-jitsu is. Can he become champion? I'm not so sure. But, you know, he's jamming up the top of that division because you imagine the next title contender is the winner of McDonald and Stephen Thompson, barring shenanigans. But if there are shenanigans, or if Roy McDonald wins and decides he's not going to fight for the UFC again because this is the last fight on his contract and he wants to kind of test free agency, if he signs with Bellator, then it's Damian Maia. But if, you know, if the winner of the McDonald-Thompson fight does fight for the belt next, he's probably going to have to fight somebody else. And I'm not quite sure who that would be, but I would not... You know, Damian Maia's pretty close to have earned his to have just having his title shot all but guaranteed. The man's on a tremendous winning streak. He's finished his last, like, he didn't finish Gunnar Nelson. He's finished, I think, two or three of his last three or four. You know, he's close. If he's not, you know, if anything happens to McDonald or Thompson, Damian Maia's your next title challenger, guys. All right. Next up, Thiago Santos knocked out Nate Marquardt in the first round, as expected. There's just too many miles on Marquardt at this point to pick him over a good, explosive, powerful striker like Santos. Francisco Trinaldo defeated Yancy Medeiros via unanimous decision. There were some weird scores here. 29-26, 30-27, and 30-26. Why do I say those are weird in the sense that a 29-26 for Trinaldo gives Trinaldo a 10-8 round one and a 10-8 round three. I'm not sure the 10-8, I can see the 10-8 round one because he knocked Medeiros down, I think, twice. So I can see that. I didn't give him a 10-8 first round. I thought Medeiros did enough to avoid a 10-8. I don't agree with either of the 30s for Trinaldo. I thought Medeiros had the second round. Flat out, thought he won that round. Trinaldo getting a 10-8 in the third is... That was a borderline 10-7, all right? I mean, it was that one-sided. That fight should have been stopped in the third round. Trinaldo just... The last, like, minute or so was just him wailing on Medeiros. Fight should have been stopped. Medeiros did enough in the closing seconds to reverse a position on the ground and land some elbows from top position to stave off a 10-7, but a clear 10-8. Relatively, the rounds that Trinaldo won, he won definitively. Round one and three, clearly Trinaldo's, and fight should have been stopped. At bantamweight, John Lineker defeated Rob Font via unanimous decision, 30-27, 29-28, and 30-26. I forget what round it was. There was a round where Lineker had a couple of knockdowns, so I disagree with the 10-8, but if you overvalue just knockdowns in an MMA context, fine. Just a bit too much for Rob Font. Lineker's pressure, wild, powerful hooks to the body and head just kind of overwhelmed him. On Fight Pass, Antonio Rogério Nogueira, Little Nog, TKO'd Patrick Cummins in the first round. This was another kind of come-to-Jesus moment for me. I have got to stop picking against Little Nog when he's fighting mediocre wrestlers. When he's fighting a good to great high-level athletic wrestler, such as Phil Davis, then he's going to struggle. When he's fighting a mediocre wrestler like Pat Cummins, he's going to win. So I picked against Nogueira there. I feel stupid. As soon as they touched gloves for that fight, I went, Nogueira's going to win this, and I'm going to feel like an idiot. So good for the Little Nog getting another win. In his hometown, he got to celebrate with his older brother. UFC also announced Big Nog is going into the UFC Hall of Fame. Well-deserved. Big Nog's awesome. At welterweight, Sergio Moraes and Luan Chagas fought to a split decision draw. 29-28 for Moraes, 29-28 for Chagas, and 28-28. I have no problems with 28-28 draw. Chagas knocked Moraes down a couple of times in the first round. Clear knockdowns, too. These were not slips. He walloped him and he fell over. Moraes, I thought, I disagreed with 29-28 for Chagas, but I think it was the second and third rounds were very competitive. I think the second one was pretty clearly for Moraes. So I have no problem with the draw. I think it's an accurate reflection of how the fight went. And kicking everything off, Renato Moicano defeated Zubaira Tuhugov via split decision. 29-28, 29-28, and 28-29. I was worried about 30-27s in this fight, more so than Moicano winning. I think I scored it for Moicano. Very competitive fight. Zubaira Tuhugov has some great entries into his takedowns. Unfortunately, he sucks at securing top position once he's kind of got a hold of you. That's where his game really needs to evolve, is the securing of position once he's made contact. That's the preliminaries. Not a bad bunch of fights, all things considered. Jeff, what do you got from there? What burning desires do you have about that group?
John Lineker is a rising star at bantamweight. I'm glad he's finally at bantamweight where he's belonged. You know, he shouldn't have waited to have so many missed weigh-ins to finally move up to bantamweight. But he's here now, and he's looking good. I'm very happy that he's at bantamweight now, where he belongs. Yancy Medeiros, dude, blocking punches with your face is not defense in this sport. I'm very surprised the fight didn't get stopped at a couple points there. A lot of people really underrate Francisco Trinaldo. He's a really tough, good veteran, and he's on an incredible winning streak right now. So you really got to start paying attention. I mean, he has 6 wins at lightweight. Now, I mean, even against not, you know, the biggest names at lightweight, to be 6 in a row at lightweight in the UFC and to have his career as long as he has had in the UFC, it's impressive. Trinaldo keeps getting better each fight, and he looked great last night. Lastly, I don't think anyone wanted to get out of Brazil faster than Matt Brown did after his fight last night. Not even Stipe Miocic. Brown got freaking assaulted while he was in Brazil. Not only was he assaulted while he was walking out for his fight with Maia, he was assaulted by his former BJJ coach while he was in Brazil as well. So there you go. And we just had an earthquake here.
Oh, that's always fun.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, Matt Brown incited the Brazilians pretty heavily going into that fight. All right. That was UFC 198. Thank you to everyone who followed along with my coverage, has commented. Jeff was there. Mark Radlett stopped by to let me know that everyone was counting on him again. Everyone was counting on me, excuse me, as he normally does. Sean Comer, Chael Sonnen's coke dealer. Billy Pilgrim, you know, just kind of the usual guy. Spanky Ham, I think, was there. Thanks to you guys for reading along, for commenting. I say this frequently about you guys, but you do a great job of being kind of good people to hang around with. You even if you disagree, you don't become childish about it. To the best of my knowledge, I've never had to deal with any of the just terrible spam in an MMA coverage thread that hits other sites, even other zones in the MMA at 411 Mania. So you guys have worked very hard to, you know, continue to make a good community there to hang out and just kind of watch and talk about the fights with. So I thank you all for that. Again, thanks. My full report is in the MMA Zone of 411 Mania. So if you didn't follow along with live coverage, stop by over there, give it a read, comment if you feel so inclined. Whatever floats your boat. All right, Jeff, any major news this week?
Yes. As you pointed out, the UFC confirmed that Antonio Rodrigo Nogueira will be inducted into the UFC Hall of Fame this July. One of the most illustrious careers in the history of the sport. Well-deserved for Nogueira, as you said, Robert. I'm very happy he's getting inducted. The other major news is that quite a few outlets were reporting that the UFC is up for sale and a Chinese media company is looking to purchase the UFC. Now, the thing about this story, which did get picked up by ESPN, by the way, there have been conflicting reports. Some reports are saying that it would be a total buyout of the UFC from Zuffa. Excuse me, who have owned the UFC, I think, for the last 16 years or so. Other sources are saying that it would only be like a partial percentage, like 10-15%. As I recall, an Abu Dhabi businessman bought a percentage of the UFC, I think about 6 years ago, for $100 million.
When they made their debut, I want to say, in the United Arab Emirates, they sold 10% to Flash Media Group. I want to say it's something like that.
Now, I mean, Dana White, you know, let's just preface this. He is, you know, the UFC president, and he is a promoter. So just, you know, think about that. He went on Dan Patrick. He was on Colin Cowherd, Opie and Anthony, and they, you know, they talked about this. He denied that, you know, that they are selling, you know, outright selling the company. But he didn't really seem to deny that, you know, there's a partial sale in place. So I think I think there is maybe some merit to this idea that they're looking to get into the Chinese marketplace by maybe selling a minority percentage of the company to someone in China, to a Chinese corporation to help with their business expansion plans in Asia. That I can very well believe. I don't think it's a total sale.
I'm with you. I'm less inclined to believe this will be a total sale. But China has a massive population. China has, I believe the Chinese, this came out, that China has the highest number of people with online presence. There's a lot of headway to be made there, and the two major media conglomerates that are Chinese media groups or telecommunications groups that have been mentioned as being involved in this discussion are the two major players within China when it comes to that. If the UFC
right.
is looking to expand,
these are the four bidders from ESPN's Darren Rovell. Now, granted, he said the UFC are in advanced talks to sell the company, not partially. But here's what he said. The bidders are WME/IMG, China Media Capital, the Blackstone Group, and Dalian Wanda Group. And the deal, he said the deal would be between $3.5 billion and $4 billion. So now, I don't know. Maybe there were some minor talks about, you know, to maybe get a valuation of how much, you know, the UFC sees what it's worth. But I don't know.
Yeah, the Wanda Group in particular is they're it when it comes to, you know, media in China. So if the UFC is looking to expand into China, they are talking with the two groups in the Chinese marketplace who are going to potentially help them expand if that's their goal.
And look, it's not just the UFC that's doing this right now. A lot of corporations and a lot of, you know, movie studios are getting into bed with, you know, Chinese companies to help with their business over there.
Those two groups that in particular kind of got mentioned from the Chinese perspective have a history of in business simply buying a percentage of media that they're going to try and get into China. I think they own percentages of a couple of, you know, major movie studios that they're helping release, things of that nature. So with those two groups in particular, that leads me to speculate that
right.
this would be a partial sale to help the UFC break into the Chinese marketplace.
Yeah, but ultimately we shall see. Now, one interesting thing that I thought was interesting, you know, whether you believe him or not, Dana White said there was an offer to buy the company. He said the first offer to buy the company was in 2010, and the offer was for, he said, $1 billion. So he wouldn't say who, but that was when they first received an offer to buy the company.
I'll say this. That wouldn't surprise me if in 2010 someone had seen kind of the way trends were going and made an offer of that particular amount to buy it out.
Now, if someone were to buy a majority, let's say a majority share of the UFC, a majority ownership, I think it would be, you know, Fox News Corp. If anyone were to do that at some point, somewhere down the line.
Yeah, they seem to be in the best position to do so, given their relationships in play at the time.
So,
all right. Yeah, that's an interesting story to see how that develops. So we're, you know, like everyone else, we're going to be keeping our eye on it.
And Misha Tate, she was going to your cyborg talk earlier about how you weren't happy with the panel. Misha Tate was doing the same thing on Twitter. She also wants Cyborg to come down to 135 to fight her for the title.
Yeah, I didn't like Misha Tate to begin with.
Okay, so here's some other news. CM Punk, look, this came from the Wrestling Observer, so it's Dave Meltzer. This report's saying that Punk has not been making good progress in terms of his live sparring sessions at Rufus Sport. This is in terms of his MMA training. And there's a lot of uncertainty around Punk because, you know, he's had shoulder issues, back issues, he's had surgeries, and his UFC debut keeps getting put off. So, gun to the head, Robert Winfrey, does CM Punk ever actually step foot inside the octagon? Yes or no?
Gun to my head, no. Let's be clear here. First of all, when this came out that, well, he's struggling with his MMA training, a man with decades of abuse on his body from professional wrestling is now struggling to make headway in his, you know, late 30s in a very physical sport. Why would it made all the sense? I mean, barring sarcasm, made all the sense in the world to me. And let's be clear here. He is currently, you know, they're talking about him fighting Mickey Gall. But if Punk has one more injury, not even necessarily a major injury, I'm not necessarily talking about like blowing out his knee. Let's just say he tweaks his back again or his elbow acts up again, because I know one of his elbows took a big, he's had problems with that for a while. Even a comparatively minor injury that is going to require surgery and push back his debut by another 6 months is basically going to be it. Jeremy Lambert wrote a beautiful piece of satire about CM Punk's actual debut a few months back in the MMA Zone of 411 Mania, which I enjoyed tremendously, but I like satire. And I'm just coming to believe that, you know, when he signed, I think he intended to fight. I think that was his – he didn't, you know, snowball anybody or anything. I think he wanted to make a run at it, and his body just is not going to be able to hold up to the rigors of training, the rigors of sparring, and, you know, the rigors of fighting. So it doesn't shock me at all. At this point, I would be more surprised if he actually fought than if he – suffered another injury and said, sorry, this is just not going to work out.
All right. believe it or not, Bellator also had a fight yesterday. Bellator 154, which saw Phil Davis beating King Muhammad Lawal by unanimous decision. He will now face Liam McGeary for the light heavyweight title. So that happened there. Also, believe it or not, Bellator fired their lightweight champion, Will Brooks. He has now vacated the lightweight title. The vacant title will now be contested between former champion Michael Chandler and Patrycki Pipo-Ferre at Bellator Dynamite 2 on June 24th. So, a new lightweight champion will be crowned in Bellator, but what do you make of Bellator firing their lightweight champion who's been beating everyone that's been put in front of him?
You know, Will Brooks has been unhappy with Bellator for a while. He's made such known publicly. At this point, fighting to keep him is more of a detriment to your company than anything. I think letting him go sign wherever he's going to sign is probably best for all parties concerned. Regarding Davis's win over Mo, I agree with Larry Zonka, who covered that the 30s for Davis were not just questionable, but so questionable that I'm starting to wonder if Bellator isn't bribing judges. Because, and I bring this up specifically because when Quentin Jackson came in and fought Lawal, Jackson got a clucky decision that I don't think anybody who saw that fight thought he won. Now you've got their new signing, and at that time Jackson was the hot new signing for Bellator. In this instance, Phil Davis, hot new signing for Bellator, gets a couple of unearned decision, scorecards against Lawal. I'm just wondering out loud, because we're bordering on patterns here. I don't know if Davis can beat Liam McGeary, but it should be a competitive fight. Brooks leaving and going wherever he goes, you know, if he's really unhappy with Bellator's management at this point, then, like I said, I'm okay with it. He doesn't want to be there. There's really no benefit to fighting to keep him. Vacate the belt. You've got two guys who kind of want to be in the company in Chandler and one of the pit bulls. They're not going to jump ship. Will Brooks might wind up in the UFC, might not. I imagine he will, but part of that depends on his asking price, so still a few questions around that. But if you've got a fighter who doesn't want to be there and management who doesn't necessarily want him there, I am completely okay with him being cut and everyone moving forward.
Bellator is not in the fight business. They are in the freak show fight business. They want the Kimbo Slice fights. They want those big, crazy fights that are going to draw ratings. They don't care about building up their divisions or building up homegrown stars anymore. They want, you know, they want big, notable matchups that will maybe turn heads and get people to switch over to Spike TV. That's what they're looking to do now. Scott Coker even said this when he became president. This is the future of Bellator. They don't care about... Look, they just stripped their heavyweight title because of inactivity. They stripped their heavyweight champion, too. So, I mean, there are no real champions in Bellator. It's that simple. They're not... All they care about is getting big fights that'll do big ratings, so that's what's important now for them. They're not looking to make sure that a guy like Will Brooks, who's 9-1 in Bellator and could have been a potential homegrown star for them, is happy and you know, could be their poster boy. That's not what they're doing. They want, you know, to service their ratings and make freak show fights. It's the freak show fight era of Bellator. And I'm not saying there's anything wrong with that. That's just what Bellator is doing right now. That's what we're looking at.
Yeah, I agree. That's the phase Bellator is in, and we're going to see how, you know, whether or not that sticks around or not. Kind of sad about Minnikov getting stripped, because Vitaly Minnikov's a pretty darn good heavyweight fighter, but if he's apparently been having visa issues, and if he can't fight for the promotion, then, you know, you do need a heavyweight champion, theoretically. All right. Anything else happened this week, Jeff?
I would say those are the major news bits in the last week.
All right. Let's go ahead and wrap up here. What movies have you seen that you have to plug reviews for?
X-Men. Apocalypse. So be on the lookout for that review. Captain America Civil War. Check out that review. And I will also be reviewing Angry Birds and probably Shane Black's The Nice Guys. So those are coming up. Check out my column on Alistair Overeem. Now that we have Miocic as champion, Overeem is definitely the next title contender. That's what should happen. Check out my column on that. I also interviewed the camp WWE head writer and showrunner, Aaron Blitzstein, who used to write for David Letterman on The Late Show. So that interview should be coming up soon. It's already in, so it should be posted in the Wrestling Zone sooner rather than later. But X-Men Apocalypse, unfortunately, is a lot closer to, I would say, X-Men 3 than it is to X-Men 2. So that was sort of the unfortunate thing.
I had such high hopes for that movie, but after it comes out, I'll see it, and Mark and I will be reviewing it.
What did you think of Civil War, by the way?
I generally enjoyed it.
Okay.
Had a few issues with it. I had a few issues with some choices that were made pertaining to the final act, specifically Tony Stark's reactions.
Well, my main issue is that Zemo is not even really Zemo, and he's not really a good villain.
Oh, you could have written him out of that story completely.
I wouldn't say written him out, but you could have made him any other character other than Baron Zemo. Him being Zemo really serves no purpose to the Marvel Cinematic Universe, considering that, I got to be honest, Baron Zemo is one of my favorite supervillains, and one of my favorite books ever is Kurt Busiek in Mark Bagley's first run on the Thunderbolts. Really one of my favorite Marvel comic stories. So, you know, to have this kind of version, and Daniel Brühl is a great actor, don't get me wrong. This kind of Zemo and name only character was a letdown. And it's unfortunate because I think all these guys working on Civil War, the Russos, the writers, Marcus and McFeely, I think are really talented guys. I just feel like a little more effort needs to be put into who these bad guys are in the Marvel Universe, other than really Loki and then the characters on the Netflix runs.
Yeah, it's sad that the Netflix exclusive, or the Netflix television series, have created so many more compelling villains than the movies have.
Yeah, but that's about it for this week for me, Robert. Thank you for your time. And I guess, are we gonna be back next week to preview the next Fight Night card?
Next week, yeah, we'll be back and we will be previewing
right.
UFC Fight Night 88, Almeida versus Garbrandt. It's a
all
really
right.
good card.
Thanks, everybody. Cleveland rocks.
See you next week, Jeff.
Bye-bye.
All right, as for me, Mark Radulich and I reviewed Captain America Civil War, which you can find in the archives here. Mark yells about the ending a little bit. I actually changed his mind about part of it, so yay me. Anyway, we talk a lot about, you know, Zemo being a non sequitur, basically. How you could have improved the movie, elements of the writing, some acting choices made by Robert Downey Jr., things like that. So you can find our review of that. You can also listen to me bang my head against a wall when we go into our critical. There's a bit at the end of those where Mark and I look at some of the criticism that has been levied at a movie, and we decide whether or not it's fair, objective, or correct in any way, shape, form, or fashion. And frequently, because Mark's the one who chooses these, he finds the ones that are designed to make me put my head through a wall and go, no, you don't know what you're talking about, you ninny. So you can listen to that this Wednesday. Mark and I will be reviewing Money Monster. I have no hope for this movie. Absolutely no hope. So tune in Wednesday. He and I will be reviewing that. No event this week. Not this coming Saturday, but next Saturday, the 29th, UFC Fight Night 88. Again, Almeida versus Garbrandt. Henan Barão moving up to featherweight to fight Jeremy Stephens. Saffedin and Story. Aljamain Sterling and Brian Caraway on the Fight Pass cards. It's a really solid card, especially for a fight night. So next week, Jeff and I will be previewing that event, as well as talking about any major news that breaks between now and then, like we do. That's everything I've got to plug. Thank you again, everyone, for being here. I appreciate it that you all make that particular conscious choice to listen to this show instead of or in addition to others. It means a lot to me, so thank you all so very much for that. Tell your friends. If you've got a friend who you think would like the show, point them in our direction and give me a chance to win them over. All right. I'll see you all next week. Until then, for Jeff Harris, I'm Robert Winfrey, and I'll remind everyone out there to please continue to be well, be safe, and behave.